baby powder. All I have to do is say the word, and you know exactly what it smells like, don't you? Baby powder. Clean and cuddly, light, a happy smell. When you stick your nose into a fresh towel, you want it to smell like the equivalent of a spring morning with mist on the grass and birds in the air and the sun rising, whatever that smells like, but that's what you want your towel to smell like. I looked around the pharmacy aisle at the grocery store, body wash. We seem to like grapefruit, but it's almost impossible to find banana. For some reason, we don't want to smell like bananas. Perhaps it's just too much sweetness, not enough citrus to balance it all off. I don't know. Smells are big business. The smell industry generates $20 billion a year globally, developing and selling the fragrances that go into our laundry detergents, our soaps and shampoos, aftershaves and perfumes, and a host of other aromatic products, including such crazy things as air fresheners and new car smell for your aging vehicle. There's a man, I just found out about him, it's really fascinating. His name is Luca Turin, and they say that his nose has the olfactory equivalent of perfect pitch. So he can walk into a room and tell you what's going on just by smelling the air, apparently. He can detect and name even the subtlest nuances in any bouquet of fragrances. And not surprisingly, his hobby are perfumes. And he doesn't just love to smell them. He writes about them. And he writes about them as few others can. In 1992, he wrote the first ever perfume guide. And he continues to write perfume reviews. I didn't even know there was such a thing, but there you go. And he's really good at writing about fragrances. He can give raves to fragrances he likes. For example, this is just one line. Thanks to Riv Ghosh, mortals can at last know the scent of the goddess Diana's bath soap. That one he liked. He can be devastating when he doesn't like what's hitting his nose. For example, 57 for her is a sad little thing. An incongruous dried prunes note with a metallic edge that manages the rare feat of being at once cloying and harsh. And this is what he has to say about Gucci's Rush. Smells like an infant's breath mixed with his mother's hairspray. Now it's left to the reader to decide whether she wants to wear that or not. It is not easy to describe an aroma or an odor. It is so much easier to evoke memories in the minds of listeners and readers. Baby powder. All I have to say is the word, and you know what it smells like. Mothballs, shoe polish, hot cinnamon buns, freshly brewed coffee. We know those smells. In the Gospel of John, there's a beautiful scene of Jesus appearing to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. They had been out fishing, and coming ashore, they saw a charcoal fire with fish on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Come, have some breakfast." And we don't know what the scene looked like in detail, but we know very well the aroma surrounding that breakfast on the beach, that blend of smoke and grilled fish and warm bread. Today's passage from John is a great deal more intentional in drawing our attention to the fragrance of the perfume that filled the house. The house belonged to Jesus' friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus in Bethany. And Jesus stopped in for dinner the day before he entered Jerusalem for the last time. Just a short time ago, Jesus had brought life to their house. The sisters had sent him a message regarding Lazarus, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." And when Jesus arrived, he found that his friend had already been in the tomb 4 days. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. And Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to Jesus, "Lord, already there's a stench because he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said, take away the stone. And then he shouted, Lazarus, come out. And he restored him to life. In the Gospel of John, there are only two smells, two instances where our attention is drawn to the scent surrounding the scene. And both happen in Bethany. Both happen in and around the house of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. There are only two smells. The stench of death. And then the fragrance of extravagant love. And the way John tells the story gives us a strong hint which one will fill the house in the end. Jesus came to Bethany, just 2 miles outside of Jerusalem, knowing full well that his opponents in the city planned to put him to death. Death was closing in on him. He knew that this might well be their last supper together. Martha served. Lazarus was one of those at table with him, and no one noticed that Mary had gone until she came back, holding a small jar in her hands. Without a word, she knelt at Jesus' feet and poured the content of the jar on his feet. A pound of perfume made of pure nard. Don't you wish you knew what nard smelled like? I have no idea. Don't you wish you had words to describe the fragrance that filled the house at that moment of love poured out right in the face of death? Judas objected. Why wasn't this ointment sold for 300 denarii and the money given to the poor? It sounds like the voice of moral outrage, the voice of thrift and good stewardship, of advocacy and service to the poor. But Judas didn't know what Mary knew. Leave her alone, Jesus said, brushing all objections aside. Leave her alone. She bought it so that she might keep it for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. Death was closing in, and Mary knew it. And she responded with lavish love. She could have poured the fragrant oil on his head, anointing him king of Israel, preparing him for a triumphal procession into the city, but she knew where he was going. And so she dropped on her knees and poured the precious balm on his feet, preparing his body for burial. Leave her alone, Jesus said to those who would have prevented her. Leave her alone. Mary responded with lavish extravagance, pouring out her love and gratitude because she knew the extravagance of God because of this man. She knew what lay ahead for him. She knew that he would hold nothing back, and she acted on it. And so her gesture of boundless generosity became a sign of his life, his love poured out for all, a witness to the excessive nature of God's love and mercy. I find it fascinating how, just as Jesus' ministry began with wine freely poured at a wedding when the wine gave out, so the ministry of his friends began with this lavish outpouring of love and caring. To me, it was and remains the only appropriate response to God's giving. In the very next chapter, chapter 13, John tells us about the last evening Jesus spent with his disciples in the city. It was during supper, in an act curiously reminiscent of Mary's, that Jesus got up, took off his robe, tied a towel around himself, poured water into a basin, and began to wash the disciples' feet, wipe them with a towel. Then he put his robe on again and returned to the table. He said, "Did you know what I've done to you? I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet. You also ought to wash one another's feet, for I have set an example for you that you also should do as I have done to you. Just as I have loved you, you ought to love one another. Mary of Bethany was the first to live that new commandment, and she did so even before it was given, because she knew who Jesus was. The house of Jesus' friends, the house just outside the city where murderous plans were being plotted, the house of Jesus' friends became a house of witness and worship and extravagant grace. Those who lived there remembered the stench of death, but what lingered was the sweet aroma of love, a fragrance even more difficult to describe, the nard. When I think about the aroma of extravagant love, one of my favorite movies comes to mind, Babette's Feast. In a small town, 19th century Denmark, lived an old man and his two daughters. The man, called the Dean, was the leader of a small Lutheran sect, and he and his daughters led a puritanical life. After the Dean died, the sisters continued his legacy, keeping the church going, ministering to the poor. And now, many years later, things have changed. The aging churchgoers are bickering. They don't like each other very much. They're bringing up past wrongs. It's no fun. One day, a ragged-looking woman appears on the sister's doorstep with a letter from a friend. He explains that this woman, Babette Herson, has fled Paris for her life. He hopes that the sisters will be kind enough to take her in as a maid, as a cook, as she has nowhere else to go, having lost her husband and son in an uprising. Babette assures the sisters that she will work as their maid and cook for nothing, and the sisters agree to the arrangement. First, they're wary of their new maid. She speaks only French. She looks like a beggar. And she's Catholic. But as they get accustomed to her, they realize that she is strong and kind. They show her how to prepare the plain dishes to which they are accustomed, and she tweaks them just a little. And the poor love her cooking. One day, Babette finds out that she won the lottery in Paris. Just as the sisters are trying to plan a celebration of what would have been their father's 100th birthday. And Babette asks them that they allow her to prepare the meal for the occasion. And the sisters reluctantly agree. That's when Babette disappears. She's gone for several days, purchasing goods that she will need for the meal. And after her return, strange bottles and boxes and ingredients begin arriving at the house. And then the great day finally comes. The guests arrive. They chat and sing the Dean's favorite hymns. They gather around, they talk about old times, and then they sit down to the meal. Course after course, they eat food they never tasted before. They drink the finest wine. And around the table, a strange thing happens. Hard feelings start to melt. Frozen faces come alive. The men and women of the congregation begin to make amends for their recent bickering and grudges. Arguments are dropped. Past misdeeds are forgiven. They laugh and embrace. They step outside, and holding hands in a large circle, they sing under the stars. It's a beautiful scene. After the guests have left, the sisters find Babette in the kitchen, surrounded by piles of dirty dishes, pots and pans. They thank her for the fine meal. They thank her for all of her work. And that's when she admits that she was once the chef at one of Paris's finest restaurants. But when the sisters ask about her return to Paris now that she has money, she answers that she will never go back. The sisters are relieved, but surprised. And then they learn that Babette has spent her entire lottery winnings on this one meal. She has given it all away in one extravagant gesture of hospitality. What lingers is the sweet aroma of love. Still difficult to describe, but the recipe is so easy to remember. Amen.